Hi, everybody. Today is Thursday, September 25th, 2025, and our friends Richard Wolf and Michael Hudson are back with us. Welcome back.
Thanks for having us.
Glad to be here.
Yeah, please subscribe and hit the like button to help us reach in more people. And let me start with you, Richard. And what has happened with the case of the conflict in Ukraine? And it doesn't seem that Donald Trump is offering anything good for Europe. And here is what Scott Bessin said about how Europe can facilitate the process of, I don't know if he considers negotiations or defeat for Europe or destroying Europe in the case of you, for the case of Ukraine, for what's going on in Ukraine. Here is what he said.
Testing the Europeans, and the European resolve needs to stiffen. They need to put everything on the table in terms of economic sanctions. You know, that, as I told my European counterparts about 2 weeks ago, all I hear from you is that Putin wants to march into Warsaw. The one thing I'm sure of, Putin's not marching into Boston. He's not marching into Boston. So, but having said that, yeah. Poles are great allies. Before they had to be told to, they were already spending 5% of GDP.
Right.
Polish economy is one of the great success stories that since the wall came down. When the wall came down, the Polish economy, Ukraine economy were the same size. Polish economy is three times larger now. If the Ukraine economy were the size of the Polish economy, Ukraine would be financing their own war effort right now, and I doubt Putin would have come in.
Yeah. Here is, before going to your comment, Richard, here is, look at this graph. It shows that the car manufacturer Porsche in Germany was excluded from the DAX index due to a collapse in the company's shares. And I don't know what do they have to offer to Europe unless destroying their economy. It doesn't seem that they're trying to help them. They're trying to, you know, somehow complicate the situation of Europe. You're taking what's going on in the mind of the administration. Do they have anything substantial in their mind?
Well, I'm reacting partly to the nearly incoherent statements of Mr. Bessin, where he comes from and how he does his statistical work would make anyone who knows these things wonder. Poland has not had a war. To compare the Polish economy today with what it was 10 years ago or whenever he compares it, to take into account where the Ukraine economy is today, Ukraine has been made into a military operation. It was a decision of the NATO to move east and to make a confrontation with Russia in the Ukraine. Everything was devoted to making Ukraine into a military force. And it was assumed wrongly that the military force built up in Ukraine in a way that had no comparable investment in Poland at all. And so now, and Ukraine has been destroyed for the last 3 years with a massive program of economic underdevelopment, not development, the comparison of a country 3 years into a war with a country that has had no war, it's childish. It's the use of statistics to make a point. Well, what is the point? The point of Mr. Bessin is very much like most of the points of Mr. Trump, which is the war in Ukraine, from the American point of view, is no longer worth the effort. The pressure is on to use those resources in other ways to make America great again, an enormously expensive project that hasn't shown much yield so far, but involved a man achieving the president's office who promised to end the war to the American people in a few days or a few hours. Okay, here we are 8 or 9 months later. He's ended nothing. He's made an endless array of efforts. They have come to nothing. The Russians continue to move slowly and methodically westward. Ukraine is losing. It's pretty clear. If you measure it by all the usual standards and you try to get reasonable statistics, that's the conclusion, not just mine, but most of the world that watches all of this. And Mr. Trump has said most of the time, I'm out. You Europeans should take care of this. You should spend the money. You should give them the weapons. I'll make you a deal. I'll keep giving you weapons, although it's very unclear whether he meant to give them any more than he has always given Western Europe. He insists on them paying for them, which is a sign of, how shall I put it, lack of enthusiasm. He doesn't want to pay for it. The Europeans with the Americans couldn't defeat the Russians. The idea that the Europeans without the Americans are going to do it is childishly stupid. So that's out. So what have we got? Well, we've got the contradiction of Mr. Trump's speech at the UN earlier this week. In that speech, he sounds like he is going to work with the Europeans in the war in Ukraine. It sounds like he's changed his position. And he did talk with Mr. Zelensky. And if you talk with Mr. Zelensky, you're in another universe anyway. So I don't know. I don't think I can answer your question without knowing more about what's going on in Mr. Trump's increasingly, how shall I say this, bizarre expressions as to which way policy is going. So my fear is that the underlying reality, I think, is that Mr. Trump has for a long time been mostly persuaded by the people around him, both neocons and non-neocons, that the big problem for the United States is China, not Russia, and that they have learned this lesson, and the combination of it not going well in Ukraine and the need to pivot to China means that you don't want to do what is happening, namely strengthening the bonds between Russia and China. You would want to weaken them. And attacking Russia is not a way to do that. Attacking Russia teaches Russia how important its alliance with China really is. So I'm caught, and I'm left with this temporary conclusion until I get more evidence that the United States, as we have been talking about on this program for months now, the United States is a declining empire, and a declining empire with ever fewer options of what to do about its decline. It refuses to admit the decline. It refuses to engage in a search for what policies would be best to manage a decline. So it hurts the fewest people. So it takes the longest time, whatever your goals would be. It doesn't do that. Well, what else does it do? It tells itself its great problem is China. Yeah, but what? What are you going to do about it? And the answer is ad hoc. They don't know what to do. So suddenly we're talking Mr. Besant, I believe, billions of dollars to salvage the almost hopeless efforts of Mr. Milei, you know, in Argentina, whose situation is collapsing, or to ransom Mr. Bolsonaro, whose situation is collapsing, and on and on and on. These are ad hoc adjustments jerking this way and that, and then at the same time taking steps that I have to tell you are producing an anxiety around the world that the government may shut down and that the Republicans are threatening to fire everybody in the federal government in the event that that happens. And, you know, in the past, these kinds of threats would be ignored. But we now have a kind of government, and I'm going to use the word that increasingly comes to my mind when asked, how would you summarize the situation we're in? And the answer I would give you is desperate. We are watching a government that is desperate. And I understand the desperation. The national debt is out of control. I mean, you go look at the numbers. 1970, it's a few hundred billion dollars. Today, it's $37 trillion. I mean, that's craziness. This is a government sitting on a mountain of debt. It knows it. It can't continue. Liz Truss lost her prime ministership in England because she tried to borrow money and the market said, we're not lending you anymore. The United States knows it's approaching. That's it. What is it going to do? Well, you see an irrational, desperate act. You send Elon Musk in to fire half the people. That's not an efficiency move. No efficiency expert would justify that. That's just saving money as best you can. And tariffs are a way of raising some money as best you can, while you still are an important market. But the long-run effects of this, they're terrible. They're very, very dangerous policy. If other countries, as I believe we're going to discuss, are now figuring out how to reduce their relationship to the United States because it is becoming unstable and dangerous to depend on this country, what have you done to your decline? You've actually accelerated it. And that's a sign when desperate people do things, they discover, and you try to point out to them, you're making it worse, not better.
I agree with the way that Richard's framed the issue. The big picture is the United States is desperate because all of the plans that it wanted are not working. They're backfiring. And Trump is always saying that his motto is never admit defeat, always claim that you've won. And when you look at his United Nations speech, everyone's still pondering over his long rambling speech. It's you can see how bizarre it was. He tried to say that Ukraine's winning, not Russia, that Russia should have taken over or could have taken over Ukraine in a single month, even a few weeks. The war could have been over. It's as if that Putin's decision not to make his military operation more than a special military operation to protect the Russian speakers really was a failure of his ability to capture Kiev. That was never his plan at all. Well, Trump is trying to say, look how long the fighting has been going on in Ukraine. It's been going on now for 2 or 3 years. Well, look at what Russia has achieved by going slow. It has taken the last 2 years to completely exhaust Europe's and America's armaments. There are no more missiles, no more tanks, except for a skeleton crew of all this. So when Richard mentioned at the beginning, Europe depend on America for arms, there aren't any arms that are made. It takes quite a while to make missiles and arms. And it looks like it'll take 5 years for the United States to make the kind of supersonic, hypersonic missiles that that Russia already has. So you're having a bizarre situation. And the what's bizarre is that NATO's talking about a land war. And Besant is talking about U.S. invading Poland. Well, they're not going to invade Boston, but they'll invade Poland. Nobody's going to invade Poland because, as we've discussed before, no country is going advanced, complex, industrial nation, not to mention a nation subject to voters and the its own population support is going to go to the sacrificing cost of losing millions of people by trying to mount an invasion. The war is going to be fought with missiles. Europe is almost out of them. America's almost out of them. Russia is not out of them. Russia has gained strength steadily during the whole course of the war. So it's really not losing. It's in a dominant position. And I think Trump realizes this. And as Richard said, Trump saying to Europe, you're on your own. Of course, you can buy anything that you want from us to fight in Ukraine. But Ukraine is a battlefield where it's really not Ukraine. Russia's not fighting Ukraine right now, except marginally. It's fighting NATO. It's NATO that is supplying Ukraine with the missiles to attack the Russian refineries to try to prevent it from refining and exporting more oil. And it's the United States and MI6 satellite bases in Wiesbaden, Germany, and other places that are guiding all of this. So it's really the European NATO war against Russia. And I'm not sure that Trump really intends or even has any idea of how to confront China, which continues to be the focus of the neocons. The fact is that Trump's trying to fight a war on five or six fronts at the same time. And that's the only thing that I can make out of the news is we're in a kind of interregnum right now. It's as if all of the guns have been loaded and they're all ready to fire. And we're just waiting for the tripwire to occur. And the tripwires are all over the place. You have the U.S. plans for a regime change in Venezuela. It's trying to goad Venezuela into somehow protecting its fishing boats that the United States is attacking. The U.S. is putting all an armada of ships there as if to say, we're going to have our special operations guys invade you and decapitate you. What are you going to do about it? Will Venezuela be as patient as Russia is and not taking the bait? You have in Europe, Estonia's trying to claim that America's attacking its property by using that Russia is attacking its property by using the Baltic for its ships. And the Baltic has some oil platforms that Estonia claims are its own and is making bizarre claims that Russia is attacking it and it wants to attack Russian shipping. If it does that, what will Russia do? Is it trying to goad Russia into bombing the Estonian ports and the Estonian navy, two ships or whatever? It's anarchy. You have another front in the Near East, where not only is Israel expanding into Syria, Lebanon, and even Cyprus, but you have the whole Near Eastern, the Syrian destabilization there. You have in Korea and Japan, the whole, it's not a military crisis there, but it's an economic crisis. The United States demanded $350 billion from Japan, and this is so outrageous. Demand for tribute that Japan has not signed the deal yet, and there seems to be a political reaction in Japan. And in Korea, Trump is trying to say, well, Korea, if you give us $350 billion, then it'll seem perfectly normal that we should impose tribute on Japan. Well, the Korean officials have said there is no way in which we are going to agree with this demand for tribute. If we did have the $350 billion, which we don't because we're not don't have the foreign reserves that Japan has that are four times as large as those of Korea, then we'd certainly support our own industry and support our own labor. And it's cheaper to pay the tariff for the transition period than to give you $350 billion and you get to keep all the money and use it as a slush fund to give to your campaign supporters for who knows what projects that with the Hollywood accounting they use, they're never going to show a profit to share with us. And you'd only give us 10% of the profits anyway. So they've sent their foreign minister to China, and I'm sure they're talking to North Korea, to say, isn't there some kind of a deal that we can make with you, our Asian neighbors, so that we can gradually disengage from the U.S. market? We don't want to pay the tribute, and it's beyond our ability to pay Trump's demands for tribute. Can't we make some kind of an arrangement integrating with you? Well, who knows? You know, that's going to have military operations. China's going to say, well, of course, we'd love to have you as a member of our group, maybe even join the BRICS. You'll have to get rid of the military, U.S. military bases there that there are. You'll have to essentially change your foreign policy and end the whole Cold War that, in fact, end the Korean War that began in 1950 and is still officially on, where you're still an occupied power. You'll have to assert your independence. And if you're independent, then of course you'll be in a position to make an arrangement with this. Well, you're having the same fight in Central Africa that has driven out France and Belgium and the colonial powers, and the U.S. is mobilizing its al-Qaeda to do to South Africa what it had al-Qaeda do to Iraq and Syria, whose al-Qaeda leader was just welcomed with Mr. Trump in the UN meeting as a now a foreign dignitary. You're having everything up for grabs on 10 fronts, more fronts at once. And the effect is to let the whole rest of the world know that I think the rest of the world can see just what Richard has said. The U.S. is desperate to see what can it get. Well, the only continent, the only region that it's been able to conquer economically remains Europe. The rest of the world says, we've seen what the United States has done by putting NATO on rations and insisting that NATO is just an arm of U.S. policy and the U.S. economy. There must be a better deal that we can make. I think that's what is shaping the whole world for the rest of this year. But the United States has only one response: to create a military crisis, a tripwire, and the crisis is spread. The tripwires are all over the entire rest of the world on all of these fronts. It's anarchy, and nobody, I think, can forecast what's happening, because there isn't a strategy behind this crisis. When a country's in a crisis and is collapsing, it really doesn't have a strategy. When it's deindustrialized, when it's become a debtor power, when it's become desperate, all it can do is mount an ad hoc response, as Richard has mentioned. So we're living in a short-term ad hoc response. All we can do is say, well, here's the logic of the situation. It's an illogical situation to begin with.
Richard, before going to your comment, here is what Reuters reported: that the Trump administration is preparing to redirect $1.8 billion in foreign aid toward America First priorities. In the Western Hemisphere, the plan allocates $400 million to several objectives: illegal immigrants, China's growing influence in critical minerals and artificial intelligence, and the last but not the least is what Washington calls the Marxist anti-American regimes of Venezuela, Cuba, Bolivia, and Nicaragua. Go ahead, Richard.
All right. I want to remind people that are watching this program of why it makes sense to understand the United States as engaged in a desperate theatrical response to world problems. When the war in Iraq began, Ukraine began, February of 2022, Mr. Biden, then the president, and many of his top officials went on record, and no major American officials disagreed, that this war would be short, that the ruble would become rubble, that the Russian economy couldn't possibly sustain this and would collapse, and that it might even be possible, some of the more expansive ones, to imagine regime change in Russia, bye-bye Mr. Putin, and maybe divide Russia up so it was divided into many little countries like the rest of Eastern Europe is. Those were our leaders. The people in power now did not disagree with that assessment. They seconded it. Why is anyone believing the current story? Russia's exhausted. Russia can't continue. We know that that was wrong. The ruble is worth roughly what it was before the war started. It hasn't collapsed or nothing like it. The Russian economy has, according to GDP, United Nations data, has grown faster than the United States' economy for every year of the war, including right now. It turns out the war in Russia has a stimulative effect the way they've managed it. I'm not saying they've managed it beautifully in every regard, but as an economic venture, they've done with the war what the United States did with World War II. Use it to get out of the Depression, to grow faster than they could in the 1930s, which they did. And the Russians have done that also. You could pretend that this isn't so, but it is. And if you pretend it isn't, if you think you can just tell us another story, Russia's exhausted, and we don't remember 3 years ago when you told us that you knew what would happen and it's all wrong, then you're the crazy person, not us. And now about we can win the war, Mr. Zelensky says. Russia is a very serious opponent. Very well armed. It has been well armed since the Soviet time, which means at least half a century of military priority. And they were already a reasonably rich country. Let's review American wars. The war in Vietnam was a war between a highly developed military superpower and a poor, backward country, and the United States lost. The war was against the Communist Party of North Vietnam. They are in charge today. They have been in the entire interval, which is now 50 years from 1975. They managed to run a good society. And Vietnam, by the way, is one of the best performing economies in the world, run by the Communist Party, because the United States lost. Now let's go to Afghanistan. That's even poorer than Vietnam. United States against the Taliban. And we lost. Who's in charge of the Taliban today? Of Afghanistan. The Taliban. Not the United States. We didn't win in Iraq, and we're not winning in Ukraine. And instead of that being a weird idea that we're not, That shouldn't be weird to anybody. That's the record we have. We don't win wars. We lose them. Now, we don't mind because it's a stimulus to our economy that we can't afford to do without. But if it is that for us, then it can play that role for Russia, which it is doing, and shouldn't surprise anyone who thinks for a moment about all of this. Now, let me turn for a moment to this thorny question of Europe. Michael keeps reminding us, quite rightly, that the prohibition of the Europeans, which the decision they made to stop buying oil and gas from Russia as part of the great sanction program, I believe their latest iteration, even bigger than before, is the number 19 or the number 20 of sanction packages that they have passed. Russia's doing fine. Europe is a disaster. So bad that the United States, seeing that its problem is China, now looks upon the Europeans as, at worst, a drain on resources, and at best, a source of tribute to help confront China. This puts Europe into an unbelievable decline. Look, it was a declining part of the world economy anyway. The empires were lost a century ago or half a century ago, and they don't know what to do. And they've been outflanked by the United States on one end and by the Chinese and the BRICS on the other. So Europe is in a decline. And the politicians have to explain that to their people. Do they dare say, our capitalists haven't been able to keep up with the competitors in US and China? They dare not do that. Their capitalists are what keep them in office. So that's out. Who are they going to blame? Themselves? Never happened. Well, they really have two choices. They could blame the United States. They could. But that's no more doable than blaming their own capitalists. They still depend on the United States. So there's only one candidate left. Russia. Make an enormous noise about the danger of Russia. We have to rearm because of Russia. We have to cut back social welfare because of Russia. We have to decline because Russia. It has to be an endless. What we're watching in Europe is a kind of replication of the American Cold War after World War II. Everything is blamed on Russia to excuse, in the case of the United States, the building up of the American empire, and in the case of Europe, hiding the decline and its causes from its own people. That's all that's going on. The rest is just noise. All right, last point I want to make. The crisis for the United States has to do, in one way, with something which I know will scare people, but I don't know how you can avoid it. A declining empire that once was dominant economically, politically, and militarily, and ideologically. It's losing it economically. We already know that. China and the BRICS is a much larger economic wealth unit in the world economy than the United States and the G7. They crossed the two lines in the year 2020, and the gap has gotten larger every year of the last 5 years. Right? So economically, the United States is no longer dominant. Politically, it isn't either. You know how you can see that? The votes in the UN are lopsided. The 120 countries on one side and the United States and a few others on the other. More and more and more. You can't control countries in Latin America. You listed they have to list half a dozen. They used to only have to list Cuba. Now they have to list half a dozen. Why? Because it's spreading there. Because the political control of the United States is shrinking. Ideologically, Western private capitalism, which used to be the ideological cover, we are the globalizing force of the world, the private enterprise bringing the world together, bringing prosperity. Nobody believes that anymore. You had 50 years of the globalization hype be the ideological framework for the country's success. But the losers from all of that, above all here in the United States, have transformed the domestic politics here to support a Trump in office who expresses the anger and rage of those who lost from globalization. In large parts of the United States, calling someone a globalist has the same political force that used to go with the word communist. Wow. Politically, that's the ideologically, that's the framework. It doesn't work. The United States' endorsement and funding of Israel in Gaza, that is what position the Americans are in favor of freedom? What? The freedom of all those people in Gaza to die? What freedom are you talking about? And then the ultimate irony, which we are going to be talking about, I predict, in the months ahead on this program. In recent weeks, the United States government took a position, 10% of the Intel Corporation, with an option for another 5%. That's state capitalism. You know what that is? That's the act by the United States of copying the Chinese, who have a huge state enterprise sector. Roughly half the Chinese economy is state enterprise. Intel is now a state enterprise. If the workers at Intel go on strike, will Mr. Trump, who is the major shareholder now, call in ICE to take care of that problem? Wow. Mr. Trump blocked the sale of certain computer chips to China. NVIDIA and AMD, two major producers of those chips, explained to Mr. Trump, the Chinese are major users of chips because they are an enormous economy. And the BRICS is even bigger. We can't make a profit if we can't sell chips to them. Everything we did was based on that. Oh, Mr. Trump said, okay, cancel the order, but you must give me, the government, 15% of the revenue you get from selling chips to the Chinese. That's the deal we have now. Okay. That's the sincerest form of flattery that the Chinese economy could ask for. The Americans, without admitting it, without talking about it, are copying. And the reason to why? Easy to see. The IMF currently estimates the United States economy will grow about 1.5% GDP growth in 2025, down from the 2+ it had promised earlier. China's estimating 5%, India 7%, which were their numbers last year. They expect it again. You can't sustain the delusions of the United States when the rest of the world, your adversaries, India, China, in the BRICS, are growing 3 times faster than you are, 3 times more capable of doing what they're doing. I recently saw a map of Africa, and the map compared 2010 to today, so 15 years. And the map showed the percentage, the number of countries, they were marked in red, whose major trading partner was the United States versus China. Then it showed it today. Reversal. The United States was the major trading partner for most of the countries, the overwhelming majority of countries in Africa at the beginning. And that role has been completely switched. And now, for most of the countries of Africa, the vast majority, the major trading partner is China. I mean, how many signs on the wall do we need to present to a reasonable person to understand where the world is going? So that leaves the military. And the war in Ukraine raises a lot of questions that Michael summarized. The scarcity of weapons, using them up, giving them to the Ukrainians, because Mr. Zelensky seems to have become an icon for this European craziness about Russia. I don't know what Mr. Putin's plans are, and I know that you, the listener, and you, the Europeans, you don't know either. The best we can do is look at what we see, gather the evidence, and make a reasonable estimation. The explanation for why Ukraine that the Russians give make a certain sense. Are there ulterior motives we don't know? Probably. I don't know what they are. But the notion that Russia has any reason to invade the rest of Europe, it has less reason now than ever before. And Russia has not had a habit of invading Europe. Not at all. It's the other way around. Napoleon, World War I, Hitler, and the great invasions went the other way, from west to east. They dwarf on every dimension, movement the other way. So stop. This is a dangerous game. A declining empire in a desperate situation, looking to its military to solve the problem. And doing that after you've just lost five wars against much less capable opponents than Russia is that verges on the crazy.
I think Richard is quite right to provide a sense of proportion by comparing the United States and Europe's decline to China's industrial takeoff. Why are the U.S. and European declining? Why are they deindustrializing? Well, we've talked before about part of the reason is their economies have been financialized. What we're seeing in the U.S. and Europe isn't what industrial capitalism set out to be in the 19th century, in the United States, in Germany, in Britain, in all these countries, capitalism turned to an increasing role of government investment and regulation. They wanted to have a government strong enough to take on the rent-seeking powers, to end the landed aristocracies, control of the government through the House of Lords or upper houses of European governments. They wanted governments to be strong enough to take natural monopolies into the public domain and make education, healthcare, transportation, communications all public. That the whole idea was to end the whole concept of feudal privileges for real estate, for monopolies, and even for banking that had been inherited, and to essentially make lower the cost of production that employers had to pay. Well, what happened was that the finance sector joined with the real estate sector in fighting back against all this after World War One, and even before the Austrian School of Economics, though, there was a whole anti-classical reaction for the last 100 years. And what that's done is basically an attack on government power, so that if the government doesn't do the planning, you're going to leave Wall Street and the wealthy vested interests to do the planning. And that's just what's happened. Look at what Trump is doing today. He's the American foreign policy is not simply opposing Russia, opposing China, is what the Biden administration called autocracies instead of democracies. The autocracies are where the living standards are going up. Autocracies are whether labor is being upgraded and not oppressed. The democracies are Ukraine and the client oligarchies that the United States has been supported. So you've seen Trump, first of all, supporting Bolsonaro in Brazil, who has been rightly thrown in jail for trying to assassinate Lula, and indeed for replacing Lula's president, and the whole corrupt oligarchic reaction against Lula's reform. Right now, Bessent is trying to support Argentina with this crazy $20 billion loan on top of all of the IMS loans. America's doing everything it can to support libertarian craziness of just dismantling the government in favor of the financial oligarchy runs Argentina. The same thing, Venezuela's to be replaced with a Brazilian or Argentina or Pinochet type client military oligarchy under U.S. control. And at home, we have the same thing of what Trump is trying to do, of promoting a libertarian attack on government. That's what MAGA is. Well, why is China succeeding? It's succeeding by doing just what the industrial capitalist countries set out to do in the 19th century. You could call it industrial socialism, because capitalism was expected to evolve into socialism. That's what seemed natural, into a mixed economy with a government strong enough to keep what used to be rent extracting classes, the landlord class, and especially the banking class, put it in the public domain. China has kept banking in the public domain, so the Chinese credit creation and money creation isn't created to enable Chinese to make corporate takeovers, not lending money to corporations to borrow money to bid up their stock prices with stock buybacks or to simply pay out as dividends. They're actually following an industrial policy. That's really what is behind the U.S. attack on China, Russia, and potentially the whole BRICS. If they should decide, well, we don't want finance capitalism in its libertarian form. We don't want to dismantle government. We want to use government as a means of promoting industrial capital investment, to subsidize it, to provide basic infrastructure that we need to grow, to essentially run the economy by industrial engineers and say, what does the economy need? How can the government promote it by tax policy and other policy? Well, the United States says, well, that's socialism. And I think one of the reasons that the opinion polls in the United States show that most Americans prefer the word socialism to capitalism is because it works, as Richard and I've been describing and throughout all the time we've been on your interview show. And that's really what it's all about. Are we going to have libertarian austerity run by the financial oligarchy that concentrates all the wealth in the hands of the 1%, as Argentina does, as the Brazilian oligarchy behind Bolsonaro would like to do, as the United States would like to make Venezuela do, and as the United States tried to make Russia do after 1991, with its disastrous shock therapy of libertarian reforms? The United States still wants shock therapy over the entire world, which is why Trump has backed Milei in Argentina with this crazy $20 billion bailout. Argentina said, well, can't you buy our currency to support it so our oligarchy can jump ship and move all our money out? And I think Trump has said, no, we're not going to buy your, we'll make you a dollar loan. You can use the dollars to support your currency, for your, support your capital flight, like the United, the International Monetary Fund is doing, but you're going to owe us the dollars back, our currency, not your currency, which is about to plunge as soon as the IMF stops its report and support. And the IMF only supports oligarchies. The IMF fights against socialism. The IMF fights against industrialization. The IMF fights against labor with its austerity plans. And that's why the biggest IMF loan is to Ukraine to fight the war. And the second biggest IMF loan is to Argentina to promote this crazy carve-up of cutting pensions, cutting social spending, essentially cutting employment and causing the economic disaster, which is going to lead to Milei losing the next election. So quite right. The context that Richard points out is successful industrial socialism emanating from China and the countries that it's working with, or America's austerity plan of financialization and support of the 1%, the same group, that layer of the population that Trump is supporting in the United States itself.
If I could very quickly summarize the logic of what Michael has just said. In private capitalism that grew up, England, Europe, and the last 250 years, developed an ideology to celebrate itself, the organic intellectuals of that capitalism, that said that private capitalism, private profit-seeking capitalists, would unify the world in the most efficient way, creating the greatest prosperity for the greatest number. Along the way, the honest ideologues discovered that if you organize your society that way, you hold all investment hostage to the profit principle. Things won't happen unless it's profitable for a private investor to dispose of his or her capital to develop it. But the theory of externalities, which I won't go into, is a theory which the honest economists understood, that every investment that a private person makes has all kinds of consequences that the private person doesn't have to calculate. Cannot calculate because of all the ramifications of whether you build a bridge or not, whether you build a factory or not. The people who build the factory are looking for private profit. But the society has to live with all the consequences, private profit, but everything else. Now, last point. It turns out that there are many ways to develop an economy that aren't, or at least aren't initially, profitable to anybody privately, but they are to the community. And so it could be a rational person could say, if there are things that would develop our economy, but are not privately profitable, and so they will not be done by a private capitalist, we need an agency that will take advantage of those opportunities for the benefit of the community as a whole, including the capitalists. And that's called the government, which can raise the money. That's what taxes are for, and borrowing if it wants, to engage in the projects that build the economy, but are not privately profitable. Not initially, maybe not for 10, 15 years. And you know, in the West, despite the bull. We've known that. That's why we build roads and highways and harbors, and we subsidize the telephone company and many other, we even have a name for it, infrastructure. We come in with the government giving, because it's so ideologically strapped, guaranteed profit to private companies so they undertake what we know they need to be doing, but which their private profit, unsubsidized, wouldn't allow to have happen. What the Chinese are the rationalization of that. They say there's always a huge set of important development projects that are not privately profitable, but that we will do. That's why the Chinese have the best rapid rail system in the world. That's why the Chinese build out housing before people need it. That's not a failure of the market. It's an understanding that if we don't want to have a rent explosion with all of the consequences that has, like we're living through in the United States right now, then we have to do things that privately profit-driven real estate builders won't do. I mean, it's a rational way of handling what we know from that theory of externalities, the prices and the benefits, the costs and the benefits of a project other than the private profit that is or isn't involved. And those the government can guess at and take steps to deal with. Now, the proof is in the pudding. China's economic development doing that for the last 40 years has outperformed the United States every single year. That's an astonishing record. You, if you didn't know that, guess why?
Well, when Richard talks about externalities, what he means is looking at the long run instead of the short run. Short-run profits don't try to really make profits so much. They're after capital gains. They're after financial gains, stock market prices going up, essentially by deindustrializing, by using profits to buy your stocks and to pay as dividends, not to reinvest in building new factories and employing more labor. And I guess that's what Lao Tzu, the Chinese general, meant. All tactics and no strategy is a way to lose. Long-term is a strategy. Short-term are tactics. And all that the United States and European economies are based on are short-run, short-termism tactics, not strategy. And they can't acknowledge a strategy because to acknowledge a strategy is to acknowledge the role of government, which they call socialism. And I guess what Richard and I call socialism. And that is creating a hopeless set of blinders on the West. And China is free of those blinders.
You know, a final observation. In the field of psychology, I believe it is generally agreed, or at least widely agreed, that if you have traumas in your childhood, you really spend the rest of your life trying to cope with them, hopefully working your way through them to get beyond them. But in any case, having to cope with them, there is no alternative. And an awful lot of people are trapped as adults in an endless struggle with the traumas that shaped them as children. Well, let's make the same analogy for capitalism. Capitalism comes out of Europe, at least in its modern form, at a time when the European societies are referred to as absolute monarchies. You know, they're associated with Louis XIII and Louis XIV and all of the kings and queens of Europe that we make fun of in retrospect. But for capitalism to emerge out of a feudalism highly centralized, highly concentrated into absolute monarchies, gave the baby phase of capitalism a traumatic experience with governmental power. That's why the old ideology, let us be, laissez-faire, leave us alone, don't interfere, don't use, the big power is against us, the big power wants to restrain, to block, to kill us. Anti-government is a reaction to childhood trauma. Early experiments in capitalism, if you go back to Europe in the high Middle Ages, were smashed. They would get going, employers and employees, in a town, and the feudal would get their troops and come in and slaughter them all. City after city in Europe is full of that history. The government was a danger. And then when capitalism finally gets established in Europe in the 19th century, no sooner has it gotten rid of the feudal than the workers are beginning to say, we want to be the government, and they see yet another danger. The workers will take over the government, and then we'll have the powerful workers we don't trust in the position of the government we trust even less. So it's so deep in them, they have to celebrate privatization. Look at Mr. Trump. He celebrates it as he violates it every day. It's so desperate an ideology, but it has its effects. You can't do here what the Chinese did. And the result is that the United States is being outflanked by the Chinese. And in a day, in an era of nuclear weapons, if you're resorting back to military, look what you're doing. Look what danger you're flirting with. You'll win the battle and lose everything.
Well, Richard, first Russia and then China had a revolution. Does the West need a revolution? And can you look at the whole Cold War, the whole opposition to China, the BRICS, the fear of countries that are not under U.S. control, that they may have a revolution? You can look at the whole Cold War. Is will there be a revolution or not? And what kind of a revolution will there be? That's, I think, the framework for all of the anarchy that we're seeing in the last week.
Well, for me, I'm beginning to wonder about the United States because in the last week, I'm confronted with the story of a professor at a university in Texas who's fired, tenured professor. And the reason given by the administration was that he spoke at a socialist conference. That was his crime. And I live in Manhattan, where the polls suggest we're about to elect as the mayor of this city a socialist. You know what that suggests? The splitting apart of the society. Those are not reconcilable differences that I can see. And I'm seeing them more and more, as I suspect most of you are as well.
Yeah. Well, I live in the same city, Richard, and you're right. That's what's happening here.
Thank you so much, Richard and Michael, for being with us today. Great pleasure, as always.
Thank you.
See you soon. Bye-bye.